Davis. It's Cook.
May it please the court, counsel. In affirming the death sentences that were imposed upon Arthur Baird for the 1985 murders of his parents, the Indiana Supreme Court failed to independently and adequately consider, identify, and reweigh relevant mitigating evidence. The state court's finding that death was an appropriate penalty for these murders was an unreasonable application of Eighth Amendment law to the specific facts of Mr. Baird's case and was premised on an unreasonable, inaccurate determination of the facts proffered by Mr. Baird in support of the existence of two statutory mitigating circumstances involving his mental health at the time of the murders, and an inaccurate and unreasonable weighing process. The district court's finding that the Indiana Supreme Court's decision did not represent an unreasonable application of the standard established by the United States Supreme Court in cases such as Clemens versus Mississippi and Parker versus Duggar, in terms of the manner in which the reweighing was conducted, was in error.
Ms. Cook, could I ask you whether you have any Supreme Court cases that dictate exactly how much weight a state Supreme Court is required to give to any particular kind of mitigating factor?
No, Your Honor.
So in that case, how could the Indiana Supreme Court be criticized for failing to give the amount of weight that you think should have been given to these mental health factors, or perhaps, you know, even somebody else might have given? But if there's no specified weight to be given, how can they be wrong?
Well, I think they're wrong initially in failing to identify at all one of the statutory mental health mitigators that was in existence. And secondly, they are incorrect when they assign low or minimal weight to the second mitigating factor. One of the reasons that we know that that's incorrect is because there were actually three murders involved in this case, the first being the murder of Mr. Baird's wife, Nadine. When the Indiana Supreme Court and the trial court as well reviewed the mitigating circumstances with respect to Nadine's death, they found that there were substantial mitigating circumstances arising out of Mr. Baird's mental health condition at the time of that murder, which occurred just a few hours prior to the murder of the parents.
About 12 hours before, though, but
yes,
didn't it appear that the jury, you know, again, I realize there was expert testimony with respect to the mental health consequences of this, but the jury seemed to think that that intervening 12 hours was of significance in terms of his ability to collect his thoughts and do something different, perhaps, for his parents.
Well, we don't have any specific verdict that tells us what the jury considered. We do know what the Indiana Supreme Court considered with respect to that 12-hour period. And the fact upon...
they considered it significant, but they didn't say it was not entitled any weight. They said that he was... was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance when the murders were committed.
Yes, Your Honor.
So is it your view they just didn't give enough weight to his mental problems?
It's my view that there was a second statutory mitigating circumstance, that being the fact that as a result of his mental condition, his ability to conform his conduct to the dictates of the law was substantially impaired, which was ignored altogether, and that the Indiana Supreme Court relied on a factually incorrect...
I don't understand that because when they talk about him acting under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance, and when he... And in the previous sentence, they talk about committed that he was compelled to protect himself from them, from having his plans unmasked. That's saying that the effect of this mental or emotional disturbance is to make it more difficult for him to conform his behavior to law. So they are considering that factor. They're just not giving it as much weight as you want. Isn't that true?
I believe that they're not giving it appropriate weight because there is a factual inaccuracy
in the Supreme Court's opinion.
Yes, Your
Honor. Where is that?
The factual inaccuracy is that the Supreme Court made a finding that Mr. Baird was conscious of his own guilt. They talk about the fact that he had good memory and recall, apparently agreeing with the conclusion of the trial court that the murders of his parents were cold and calculated acts to preserve his dignity. And
what are you pointing to specifically? The discussion of the mitigating circumstances is on page 26 of your appendix.
Yes, I don't have that in front of me.
Well, is that what you're referring to? I mean, where is this inaccuracy?
The inaccuracy is in their discussion of the fact that he spent a period of time between the murders and took actions which they believe to have been deceptive during that period of time.
Well, they discuss that elsewhere in the opinion, as I recall, and they point out that he lied to the in-laws and so on. Is that the part that you're talking about?
Yes, in part, Your Honor. I think that there is a misunderstanding of the nature of Mr. Baird's mental illness. Both the trial court and the Indiana Supreme Court seem to believe that the fact that he was conscious of the wrongfulness of his actions had something to do with the nature of his mental illness and somehow belied the fact...
Oh, I don't understand you. What is his mental illness, by the way?
He had a delusional disorder which caused him to have fantastical beliefs that were not grounded in reality. As a result of that delusional disorder, when it was challenged by the fact that some of those fantasies were not being played out in the manner that he thought, he had a psychotic reaction and an episode during which period of time he believed that he had lost control of his ability to act on his own.
Yeah, I don't see anything in that statement that's inconsistent with the court's description.
Well, it would be my position.
Well, he realized his grandiose plans would be exposed and he was compelled to protect himself from them. That's the operation of his mental and... I mean, they do call it an extreme mental or emotional disturbance. I mean, maybe your view is an extreme mental or emotional disturbance precludes the death penalty. But I thought you were arguing that somehow they'd made an error of some sort. I don't know what the error was.
I'm arguing that the error is...
You're not able to point to any specific language, so I'm not sure what you're...
Well, I thought what you were saying was that with these... And this is largely based on the testimony of the psychiatrist at the post-conviction hearing, not the evidence that was at the trial, was that with these delusional disorders, even though you can control lots of other things, you can't control your response to the delusion, and that the court's discussion, and I think it's actually back on page 21, maybe if you should probably have your appendix with you. Back on page 21, the court's rehearsing a number of his deliberate acts. It's saying, it's talking about the testimony before the trial court that the appellant was able to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct and that he was taking deliberate acts
in response to that.
It's the second column on page 21. It's 1177 in the Indiana report. And there's a head note 5. He killed his parents 14 hours later, covered the mother's mouth, again deceived his wife's parents, deceived a Jasper police officer, and so forth. So the Indiana court reviews all of these deliberate acts he took, which... I mean, again, I get back to the standard of review under the Anti-Terrorism Act. If that's a view of the evidence, and the court could have taken that view, and you've agreed that there's nothing in the Supreme Court that dictates the weight that should be given to mental condition, it's hard for me to see how a federal court on habeas corpus can say that that was unreasonable.
The difference between the testimony that was provided at the post-conviction hearing with respect to the nature of Mr. Baird's mental illness and that provided during the trial was that by the time of the post-conviction hearing, there had been advances in the study of delusional disorders. At the time of the trial, there were no diagnoses of delusional disorders because the DSM-3 didn't recognize them as a mental illness separate from persons who suffered from alcohol or drug addiction, which Mr. Baird did not. That's why we had diagnoses that were kind of all over the board without any real understanding of the effect of a delusional disorder upon an individual's behavior and how it would contribute to a psychosis or a psychotic episode.
You're not arguing, are you, with the court's finding that this mental illness did not prevent him from realizing that he was acting wrongfully?
No, Judge. His mental illness did not preclude.
You're focusing on the compulsion.
Yes.
Well, but the court does discuss the compulsive aspect of his disorder.
It does.
So what's missing from that?
Well, it assigns very low weight to that mitigating circumstance
right.
with
now,
respect to the death
of the parent.
But that's
a judgment, isn't it? I mean, it attaches low weight because people have different views as to... I mean, what I found the psychiatric testimony extremely foggy. I didn't get a strong sense they knew what they were talking about, any of them.
I think they didn't know what they were talking
right.
about because they
but
didn't understand.
Doesn't that mean that the court has to make a judgment how much weight it should give to ambiguous psychiatric evidence which shows at a minimum that this person was not in full control of himself? What more can they do?
It made that judgment and found that it constituted a substantial mitigating circumstance sufficient to outweigh the aggravating circumstances.
Well, what do you mean it found? I don't understand you. What?
I'm sorry?
I don't understand you.
With respect to the death of Nadine Baird, it did make a determination that was a substantial
yes, but
mitigating
circumstance. Yes, it thought the 12 hours made a difference. It didn't say it made all the difference. In fact, it disagreed with the trial court about that and said we're inclined to find mental condition time as murder of his parents is entitled to some mitigating value. And then the court goes on and explains psychiatric evidence supports determination he's an obsessive compulsive disorder that was operative when he killed his parents. So is your argument they just didn't give enough weight to this compulsion?
My argument is that they should have identified another statutory mitigating circumstance. They did not give sufficient weight to the statutory mitigating circumstance, which they did find, and therefore the weighing process was not accurate. And I think that there is no basis in the record for finding that there is a substantial difference between his mental condition at the time of the murder of Nadine Baird and at the time of the murder of the parents.
Ms. Cook, the Supreme Court of Indiana, in its opinion, says that the appellant was so obsessed with the idea of buying this farm that he set out a closing date, etc. And then it goes on and says, and he finally realized that his grandiose plans would be exposed as a mere fantasy to these persons whose derision would be most destructive to him. He was compelled to protect himself from them. What evidence in the record supports that conclusion by the Indiana Supreme Court? Is there any record?
There's no evidence whatsoever in the record to support that. In fact, all of the mental health experts agree that his beliefs were sincerely held beliefs. None of them suggest that there was ever a point in time, including the time when he was evaluated by them, when he understood that his beliefs were fantastical or delusional, which is the very...
So you mean there's no connection between the impending collapse of these plans of his and the murders?
I believe that the connection was that he had scheduled the closing. He still didn't have the money, which he believed that he was going to get from somewhere, and he couldn't explain to himself why these things weren't happening, and that caused stress, which in turn caused a psychotic break, and he acted in a disassociative state as a result of that psychosis.
Is that significantly different from what the court is saying?
The court, yes, it is. The court believes that Mr. Baird realized that he was his ideas were fantastical and decided to protect himself from the derision of the people that he loved. There's no evidence in the record for that.
Oh, I think you're misunderstanding the court. You think the court thinks that this counts against him.
Yeah,
I don't think that you're reading correctly. This is the compulsion. In other words, the court is explaining why it agrees that he was acting under the mental or emotional disturbance, that when his plans were exposed, he felt he was compelled to do something. That's part of the compulsion. That's not part of his, you know, mens rea.
Mr. Beard never felt that his plans were exposed.
What difference does it make? The point is, when his dream collapsed for whatever reason, he went crazy and did this. I think that's what the court is saying, right? Finally, Appellant was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance when the murders were committed.
There's no rational difference.
Which is what you think, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But there's no rational difference between his mental condition at the time of the murder of Nadine Baird.
Well, the court disagrees.
They point to matters such as the letters that he wrote between the time of the first murder and the time of the second when he's concerned with somebody and after.
No, that's not part of their discussion of the compulsion issue. Compulsion thing, they just say maybe it's skimpy or something. I don't know what you're supposed to say. They do think that he was acting under compulsion, but obviously they give way to the fact that he had a day to reconsider.
But during the day to reconsider, we have to look at the facts of what happened during that day of reconsideration, you know, which includes him being concerned about someone finishing canning the pickles that his mother left when he murdered her, or giving a Christian burial to the chickens who didn't have enough feed left. These were not rational letters written by somebody who was in control of his faculties at the time. This was somebody who was operating within the context of a delusion.
Yes, I know, but that's what the court is saying, that he was acting under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance when the murders were committed.
But is it, I mean, just to get to this, so if it's your view that the court thinks he could nonetheless control his actions, or if it's your view that somebody who has absolutely no control over his actions shouldn't be given capital punishment, then maybe that's the precise point we need to come to consider whether the Supreme Court has ever said that it's unconstitutional to impose death penalty against somebody who has literally no control over his actions. And then one could ask, is Mr. Baird such a person, or did the Indiana Supreme Court reasonably conclude that Mr. Baird had enough control over his actions at the time he murdered his parents that there's no constitutional problem?
I believe that Mr. Baird is such a person, and I believe that the United States Supreme Court has not addressed specifically that issue.
So how, again, I get back to this, how can we do anything on habeas then if they've never said it? How could the Indiana Supreme Court be called unreasonable?
Well, because the Eighth Amendment does prohibit the imposition of cruel and unusual punishment, and I believe that we could make a finding and a determination that the death penalty constitutes cruel and unusual punishment and is inappropriate for persons whose conduct is motivated by involuntary factors beyond their control.
Does Mr. Baird understand right now that he's facing the death penalty?
Yes, he does, Your Honor. It would be my position that the death penalty can only be justified if there is a unique combination of aggravating and mitigating circumstances which surrounds an individual defendant, and that requires a consideration of all of the relevant mitigating evidence. In terms of the consideration of that...
What do you think they didn't consider?
I think that they did not find as a mitigating circumstance what we call the statutory C6 mitigator, that he was unable to control his actions.
Well, but that's exactly what they're discussing here, compulsion.
Well, what they discussed is the fact that he had a mental condition, that he suffered from a mental disease or defect.
That's a different part of the list. That's not your C6 factor. So From a statutory interpretation point of view, it's your position that they must mean something different.
Yeah, they refer to the C2 factor, which is that he committed the murders while under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance, but don't consider the other statutory mitigator that he did so because he was unable to conform his conduct
to the
requirements of the
law. Well, I don't understand. What's the difference?
Well, the first does not require a volitional impairment. A person
yes, but here they're discussing the volitional impairment, so it must be they're talking about the other. I don't understand you.
They don't find a volitional impairment.
Well, no, that's what they're talking about, compulsion, acting under compulsion.
There is no finding by the Indiana Supreme Court that he was unable to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law, only a finding that he acted under extreme mental or emotional disturbance.
That's right. That's what they say, which tracks the language of the C2 factor, I guess. We
yes,
find
it
that
is.
Appellant was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance when the murders were committed.
Yes. 1 year prior to these murders, Indiana's insanity defense statute provided a complete defense for individuals such as Mr. Baird who were unable to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. It's hard to see how what in 1984 would have provided him with a defense to a conviction in 1985 is not even a significant mitigating factor.
Well, we don't. There's no finding as to how far he was under compulsion. I mean, these are, you know, not clear he would have had a defense
well,
under the old statute.
That's because they didn't make that finding. That's why we don't have that determination in the record. And because they didn't make that finding, and because they didn't assign the appropriate amount of weight to the mitigator, they could not complete the reweighing process in an appropriate fashion. They gave too little weight to it and too great weight to the aggravating factor.
It sounds to me like your real argument isn't an argument that there's too little weight to this C6 factor, because and that argument is really hard to imagine how that's going to go anywhere given the Supreme Court jurisprudence. But if they completely ignore a mitigating factor and fail to put it into the weighing process in a weighing state, that sounds to me like a somewhat different kind of argument to make.
It's not referenced at all in their statement of reasons.
So
do you make this argument in your brief?
I make the argument that there were two mitigating factors, statutory mitigators, that should have been recognized.
Well, did you argue that they failed to discuss the second? I didn't remember that. I'm not saying you didn't, I just don't remember. Let me ask you about the other issue. This is about the confession. Is this an argument about the death penalty, or is it about his being convicted?
I believe that's an argument that goes primarily to the conviction, Your Honor.
But there isn't any question that he was the murderer, is there?
No, Your Honor.
So what's the point?
I'm arguing...
You really want a new trial on guilt?
The request on habeas was that the case be remanded for resentencing and not for a new trial.
If you don't want a new trial, what's the relevance of the confession issue?
I argued it for the brief, Your Honor, because I thought that it ought to be presented to the court and argued.
Do you want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Mr. Creason?
May it please the court. The Indiana Supreme Court properly found Mr. Baird's extreme emotional or mental disturbance at the time of the murder of his parents to be a mitigating factor, correctly considered it, and gave it some weight in accordance with the United States Constitution. That is all that the federal Constitution requires.
Well, but Ms. Cook says they only considered it under one mitigation head and they should have looked at the other.
Speaking frankly, it does not appear from Mr. Baird's brief that sort of argument was fully fleshed out, if made at all.
Was it made at all? I don't remember it.
It does not appear from my review just now of the brief, or in our preparation of our brief, that that was an issue raised either in the district court or here, or for that matter, in the Indiana Supreme Court, or even asserted to the trial court.
She mentioned on 19 and 20, both subpart 2 and subpart 6, but I was just flipping through it to see. Because it does seem as though the statute approaches mental health from a couple of different angles, right? And so if you just say there's a mental health problem, then maybe greater specificity is necessary. It seems to me pretty clear the Indiana Supreme Court was focusing on the first of them, the C2 factor, just looking at the language that the court uses. So should we go back and look and see if this other point, the volitional point, was preserved?
Yes, we do ask that you do that, and I'm sorry that I'm not able to definitively say that it was not. It is news to me. However,
you've been involved in this case for the duration or for a long time?
No, Your Honor. I'm standing in for counsel
for
the brief.
Okay.
However, I have been involved on the side as his supervisor. To the extent that the jury had the option of finding Mr. Baird guilty, not guilty, guilty but mentally ill, or not responsible by reason of insanity. And the jury found him guilty of all counts. To the extent that the volitional, that was answered by the jury. It rejected that
right,
sort
but that
of
that wasn't part of Indiana law anymore, right? Indiana law had been changed to get rid of that volitional aspect, right?
My understanding is that it is not eliminated. Instead, you have to show, I could be mistaken about that, and but not entirely eliminated. To any event, the Indiana Supreme Court's decision encompasses that discussion. When it says that he was compelled to do this, that is, in the state's opinion, the Indiana Supreme Court saying he lacked control over his actions, and he was compelled to murder his parents and his wife in order to cover up his failure regarding the farm. That is exactly the sort of volitional requirement that Mr. Baird now asks this court to consider.
I understand the Cook's argument to be, though, that I suppose if we deconstruct that word compelled, we could assume, option A is that he felt that he rationally felt that he had no other choice but to eliminate these people who were going to catch him in the delusion, or B, something inside his head just snaps and he just does these things without having any idea really what he's doing. I'm just trying to understand what the arguments are, and it sounds to me like those are the two options on the table.
Our response would be that the experts who testified at trial, the Indiana Supreme Court in its direct appeal opinion did not have the benefit of post-conviction experts or changes in the diagnostic and statistical manual. At trial and at the penalty phases, four doctors testified. Only one of them found him insane, but even that doctor found that he knew what he was doing was wrong at the time he did it. He just couldn't overcome it, and he was suffering from a psychosis based on his delusions. The other doctors, some of them rejected that outright. Others wouldn't find him psychotic at the time and thus found him to be sane, not only at the time of trial, but also at the time of the offenses. The evidentiary support for these arguments, the present argument that we're discussing, is outweighed by at least three other, if not all, of the doctor's testimony at trial, that Mr. Baird, in fact, knew what he was doing was wrong, and at least half of the doctors said at the time of the parents, he was still kind of compelled to commit these crimes, but he knew what he was doing was wrong. He just could not conform his actions because of it. I mean, this all goes to what the real argument on direct appeal was, which is that the mental health evidence was not considered, and stressed the aggravator that was specifically addressed by specific reference to the Indiana Supreme Court.
Now, one of the, she really has, I think, two main arguments. One, this business about the second mitigating factor. I didn't see it in her brief. Maybe she'll find it. The other was that in the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion, they talk about, there's this statement about how he realized his house of cards was collapsing, and so he felt compelled to, you know, he's embarrassed or something, so he killed the people, these people. So is there any basis for that, or she said there's no basis for that?
Yes, Your Honor. Two doctors specifically testified that his plans were, in fact, grandiose. They were not based on reality. Exactly what the Indiana Supreme Court said.
No, we know that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure, but I mean, but what was the relationship between his grandiose ideas and the murders?
Yeah, who testified that there was this causal link, if you will, that as he, this is speculation about what's going on inside his head. This little sentence as he finally realized that Judge Ripple called to your opponent's attention. He finally realized that his grandiose plans would be exposed as a mere fantasy. Then he decides he's going to take further action. Where's that supporting evidence?
Dr. Bowman testified at trial, and that's found at the trial record, I believe on page 3697. It may also be on page 444. He discussed that possibility with Baird in Dr. Bowman's discussions with him, his evaluation. And Baird acknowledged that that would be plausible. He denied that that was the real reason he did it, but that that would appear to be a plausible possible chain of events.
Did Baird give any reason? Did he ever give a reason?
I'm not sure if to Dr. Bowman he did.
I mean, at any time, has he ever explained why he did this?
I'm not sure I could reliably tell you the answer to that question. Dr. Minhee, I believe is how it's pronounced, also acknowledged that this was the psychologist, or psychiatrist, excuse me, who testified that Baird was in fact insane at the time. He testified that this hypothesis of Baird's motivations was excellent, and that the events may have been triggered when he was faced with the realization that his plans were not going to succeed. The trial record sites that we cite in our brief are pages 472, 476, 3673. That is the basis for the Indiana Supreme Court's findings regarding what motivated him. That is not an objectively unreasonable determination of the facts, because it is fairly supported in the record, at least as a hypothesis, something which, as fact finders in appellate reweighing, the Indiana Supreme Court was open to do. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that the determination of weight, the weighing process, is a job for the state courts, and not it or the federal courts. That is because the concern, the constitutional concern, is that the proffered mitigating circumstances are considered. Once that is done, with relation to mitigating circumstances, defendant has received an individualized sentencing determination. That is exactly what the Indiana Supreme Court did. It considered the weight of Mr. Baird's mental health arguments, which the jury rejected in the guilt phase, and found it mitigating. Found error, reweighed, and gave it low weight. With respect to the court, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that is not something that is a cognizable claim in federal court. That instead, that determination is left to the states, because the federal constitution is not concerned with the ultimate sentence determination so long as it is fair and not arbitrary and capricious.
What are we to do with the fact that the mental health profession itself appears to evolve over time and perhaps, you know, to put it maybe in its most positive light, people understand more about what kinds of mental health disorders exist, and we then have the testimony of the psychiatrist at the post-conviction stage says we now actually understand much more about delusional disorders, and that's what Mr. Baird had, and he was not a normal human volitional actor at the time he committed any of the three murders.
The sentencing determinations are based on the evidence available at the time the determination is made.
Right, but I understand that, but suppose, just to change the facts a little bit, which, you know, granting is not our case, suppose by the time of the post-conviction hearing, it had been discovered that there was simply a chemical imbalance in the brain that caused people to behave this way, and if you gave them, you know, lithium or whatever, some sort of corrective medication, the person would be fine, but people with this chemical imbalance were going to behave kind of like Tourette syndrome or whatever. We know that there are some physically based mental disorders, and would you say that did you go ahead and execute somebody anyway, even though you now discover that it was a physically based mental disorder? I mean, surely some later information must be pertinent. Maybe not this, but there must be something.
Perhaps so. I'm not willing to say that across the board in all cases. Our changed understanding of mental health may suggest a sentence to be inappropriate. However, so long as the process by which the sentencing was fair and not arbitrary and capricious, it satisfies the requirements of the Eighth Amendment. As the United States Supreme Court has not gone the next step, as Your Honor suggested, it may at some time, but it has not gone so far as to say, if you can show that you just had no control, that you should not receive the death penalty. That is not...
Well, is there some law on this? Because I don't think either the district judge or the Miss Cook, I don't think discusses the interrelation between the post-conviction hearing and the Supreme Court decision. Her attack is entirely on the Supreme Court decision, which of course preceded the post-conviction. And Judge McKinney, he talks about the evidence, but he doesn't. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't frame an issue concerning the significance of post-sentence evidence. Couldn't it be newly discovered evidence? Has any effort been made to treat this as a, you know, the exception to the habeas corpus statute for newly discovered evidence?
No. To last question, the exception would only be to excuse procedural default. Newly discovered evidence in and of itself is not a constitutional claim, and relief cannot be granted on that.
Well, yes, it can. I mean, the second part of if there's newly discovered evidence that's clear and convincing evidence, the statute does allow us to look at that.
Newly discovered evidence which showed that the court had made a mistake, had made an innocent Supreme Court of Indiana, the Indiana Supreme Court made an innocent mistake. But never, I mean, we'd like, suppose it turned out Baird wasn't a murderer, likely, but wouldn't that be the basis for a new habeas corpus petition?
Well, it would suggest that he's actually innocent, and if he can establish, if this court has held, the actual innocence exception, and the United States Supreme Court has, applies only to excuse procedural default. A new claim, perhaps, given rise, or is created by some newly discovered evidence.
But the newly discovered evidence, I suppose maybe to make it as clear as I can, if it were discovered that people who are missing a certain gene sequence simply couldn't do something, couldn't recognize who it was, the face of who it was they were killing or some such thing, and you discovered 10 years later that he was in fact missing that gene sequence, the kind of thing, in other words, that would have been the case at the time, it's just that we didn't have enough knowledge then to recognize its significance, it strikes me that that's the kind of thing post-conviction proceedings, especially if capital punishment is at stake, are good for, because the U.S. Supreme Court has said that you can't execute people who are mentally ill. And how far one takes that, I'm sure, is a matter of debate. But when we get this testimony at the post-conviction about Mr. Baird and his ability to control himself, I'm a little troubled with the thought that it has no weight in the equation.
In some cases, that may be a concern. The nature of the post-conviction evidence is not so fundamentally different as Your Honor suggested. It is, if I may simplify it, and granted it is my simplification, not a doctor's, the DSM-IV has given a new name to what was considered something else at the time. It wasn't that it was totally undiscovered, it's just that we know something more about it and we want to classify it better to take it out of something else and not lump it in kind of a catch-all, alcoholism, other things, and make it something different. Each psychiatrist that examined Mr. Baird came with a different conclusion as to what he was suffering, if anything, at the time of these crimes. That's the nature of a behavioral science. If physical science, such as genetics, could show something different, that is a different matter. But merely finding on post-conviction another doctor to testify to essentially the same type of evidence, but putting a new spin on it, doesn't meet the newly discovered evidence test. It would have been available at the time. Just it wouldn't have had the same name. That certainly, in the state's opinion, does not rise to any level that habeas relief would be appropriate on, let alone relief in state courts. If that answers Your Honor's question, the Indiana Supreme Court fully understood Mr. Baird's mental disturbance, unlike the trial court, and gave it the full weight that it deserves.
I don't think anyone understands his condition, actually.
Perhaps
that's the problem, right? I mean, what he did was bizarre, extremely bizarre. He sounds like, insane. But on the other hand, we don't know what weight to give to that, right?
Different people may disagree as to what weight it has been given, but it is not objectively unreasonable for the Indiana Supreme Court to have given it low weight. When the jury rejected it in the guilt phase and found him guilty, and the doctors couldn't agree in the first place on, each doctor gave a different example. So perhaps the Indiana Supreme Court did not know, but they certainly understood the thrust of defendant's argument. And he is entitled to consideration of that. The Constitution allows that. The Indiana Supreme Court gave it that consideration. It is not a cognizable claim on habeas review or even to the United States Supreme Court on direct review to challenge what weight that is given. If it is not cognizable on direct review, certainly it is not a grounds for habeas relief at this date. Respectfully, the district court properly denied Mr. Baird's petition for writ of habeas corpus, and the state asks that you affirm that decision.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Creason. Ms. Cook, how much time does she have? 3 minutes?
The court did raise the question of whether the argument about the C6 mitigator was addressed below.
The first question, is it addressed in your brief?
Yes, it is.
Where?
Beginning on page 19, where I set forth the mitigating factors of C2 and C6. and argue that the evidence...
Sure, but you don't say that they failed to consider 6, that the Indiana Supreme Court failed to consider it.
Well, I argue that the court failed to identify and weigh.
You don't say anything about it being a failure to have looked just at 3 and not at 6. You treat them as interchangeable. You don't suggest there's any difference so that the court's failure to mention C6 somehow undermines its decision.
Well, I think that...
Never suggested that.
I think that in reading the language of the Supreme Court's opinion, one can also...
I'm looking at your brief. I don't think you made this argument. I think you just thought it up for this oral argument. You didn't make it in your brief.
Judge, I believe that whether the court finds that it's specifically set forth in the brief or not, the issue is still...
Well, you're springing it on everybody. No one thought before you made your opening argument that one of the problems was that the Indiana Supreme Court had failed to mention and discuss the interrelation between these two overlapping statutory provisions. The other thing I don't understand about your brief, what weight do you give to the evidence presented at the post-conviction hearing?
That wasn't litigated before the habeas court.
So we shouldn't consider it, should we?
One of the reasons that the post-conviction petition was denied was because the Indiana Supreme Court, as the trial court, found that the evidence was not newly discovered but was merely cumulative. And given that finding, I didn't believe that there was a basis for arguing it before the habeas court.
So that's out. That's not for us to consider.
I don't agree with that determination, but I did not believe that I had a vehicle for presenting on habeas.
Now, why isn't what Mr. Creason said about this business about the connection between his delusion and his killing his wife and parents, why isn't what he said, I mean, maybe he was misstating, so I want to give you a chance to comment on it, but what he said was that one of the psychiatrists proposed this to Baird, and apparently they agreed, yeah, it's plausible, but Baird denied it. And another of the psychiatrists said, yes, it was an excellent hypothesis. Now, if that's an accurate statement of the record, isn't that something from which the Indiana Supreme Court could reasonably infer, yeah, this is, you know, this maybe this is the nature of the compulsion. He was so distressed when his house of cards collapsed that he committed these crimes, which is what the Indiana Supreme Court said.
I don't believe that any of the mental health experts concluded that was the case.
No, I didn't conclude, but did Mr. Creason accurately represent what the record...
Yes, Your Honor,
yes.
He did. But I don't believe that was the conclusion of any of the mental health experts. They testified, they submitted reports to the court, and there was a lot...
No, it's not their conclusion. It's a question whether the Indiana Supreme Court was going berserk or you know, making things up or... When it actually it didn't say that. It said he was compelled to protect himself. It didn't explain what they thought.
None of the experts who testified.
Isn't it sort of common ground that the impending collapse of his scheme precipitated this psychotic episode? I mean, you and Mr. Creason agree on that, don't you?
Yes. I agree with that the impending collapse precipitated a psychotic episode, but he was unable to act volitionally at that point. And the argument is that someone who is impaired to the extent that they don't have any volitional control over their actions shouldn't be executed. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cook. And, of course, you were appointed.
Yes,
and the court thanks you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. Thank